My brothers and sisters, contrary to my usual custom, practice, I intend to read what I have to say today. I assure you, I have tried to prepare it under the influence of our Heavenly Father. And I humbly pray that it will carry the message which I had hoped for. I plan to say something today about the Constitution of the United States of America, its framers, and some of its essential principles. America, a land choice above all other lands. For our great and priceless liberties, including the security of our homes and property, our freedom of speech and of the press, freedom of religion and the free exercise thereof, indeed freedom itself and its liberties, as our fathers knew and enjoyed, as also ourselves, depend upon its preservation. As there is more detail, and as I wish to be as accurate as I may be, I have written out what I wish to say. It seems wise to remind ourselves of these matters because some people belittle that great document and its fundamental principles, sometimes to the point of derision. Sometimes we forget it. These defamers say that the Constitution and our government under it are outmoded, not responsive to present-day conditions of life and living, not sufficient to meet and solve present-day problems, and that we need a modern, up-to-date system of government. They let us know what should be done to meet their ideas and plans, which seem always to run to despotism. I have observed that numbers of these defamers take advantage to the utmost of every liberty and freedom created and protected by the Constitution in order to destroy it and its guarantees, so to make easy the setting up of a tyranny that would deprive the common man of his freedom under it. So permitting these defamers to set up a government that would give place, power, and privilege to them in a despotism to be imposed upon the mass of mankind. We have witnessed this very despotism. There would be a Kremlin in every country of the globe, all under the super Kremlin in Moscow. One class of these defamers are the same persons who declare the Ten Commandments, the basic law of the civilized world, to be outmoded, although these commandments still speak with their divine power and authority against the same existing evils today, each one of them, not one missing, even as they existed in the days of Moses. Commandments that proclaim righteous principles that are as valid and applicable today as when on Mount Sinai they were written on slabs of stone by the finger of God. The same people declare the Sermon on the Mount to be outmoded, irresponsive to the needs of the people of today. The divine truths of the sermon, its surpassing loveliness, indeed the sublimity of its ethical teachings, do not, say they, harmonize with their modern life, where we see greed, ambition, selfishness, dishonesty, deceit, falsehood and licentiousness thrive and on which they live and write. We have noted this experiment also. The Constitution of the United States was framed in Independence Hall, Philadelphia, May 14, 1787 to September 17, 1787. The framers were delegates sent there too by the 13 colonies. 74 were appointed, 55 responded, reported at the convention, 19 did not attend, 39 signed the Constitution. Representatives signed from each of the colonies except Rhode Island. The Constitution is signed like the Bill of Rights, though these rights were discussed in the convention. As the colonies voted to ratify the Constitution, each proposed amendments to remedy this omission. Over 100 amendments were proposed. The final return showed that 10 had been ratified. The framers and their fathers had in the preceding 75 years fought through 4 purely European wars. In America, between the British and her colonies on the one side, and the French and her Indian allies on the other. The colonists had little, if any, concern in the European issues. They fought because the homelands fought. In the first 3 of these wars, the colonists lost much, suffered massacres, yet at the end of each war, each European government returned, each to the other, the ground either had made in America. No wonder Washington, in his farewell address, counseled against foreign entanglements. He stated the reasons drawn from colonial experience. The French and Indian War, the last of the 4, broke the French foothold on the continent. Washington participated in that war as an officer and suffered in Braddock's defeat at Fort Duquesne. The movement for independence began soon after the close of the French and Indian War. Some of the very best minds and ablest in the colonies participated. Framers served on these earlier revolutionary bodies. Many framers were members of the Continental Congress. When the revolution came, they had the experience, bitter as to both men and money, that came to that Congress in raising troops and materials for war. Some were experienced in the actual problems of conducting a war. One at least, Franklin, had seen distinguished service in the diplomatic field and continued so to serve. The framers were men of affairs in their own right. Some were distinguished financiers. More than half of them were university men. Some educated in the leading American colleges, Harvard, Yale, Columbia, Princeton, William and Mary. Others in the great colleges of Great Britain, Oxford, Glasgow, and Edinburgh. Washington and Franklin were among those who had no college education. They were men of varied political beliefs. Some were Federalists, some were anti-Federalists. Some seemed favorable to a mere revamping of the Articles of Confederation. The amazing thing is that there was not, in all the world's history, a government organization, even among confederacies, that could be taken by the framers as a preliminary blueprint for building the political structure they were to build. Franklin declared, "We have gone back to ancient history for models of government and examined the different forms of those republics which, having been formed with the seeds of their own dissolution, now no longer exist, and we have viewed modern states all around Europe, but find none of their constitutions suitable to our circumstances." They had been in session for about a month when Madison declared, "As it was more than probable, we were now digesting a plan which in its operations would decide forever the fate of republican government, we ought not only to provide every guard to liberty that its preservation could require, but be equally careful to supply the defects which our own experience had particularly pointed out." A little further detail about the 39 framers who actually signed the document will be useful. Of these 39 signers, 26 had seen service in the Continental Congress. They knew legislative procedures and problems. 13 had served both in the Continental Congress and in the Army. What a wealth of experience they had obtained in both legislative and executive duties. Of the 19 who served in the Army, 17 had served as officers. They knew the problems of armed forces in the field. And of these 17, 4 had served on Washington's staff. Let us go down the road. Washington, the father of his country, and Madison, sometimes called the father of the Constitution, were later presidents of the United States. Hamilton, a financial genius, was Secretary of the Treasury under Washington. McHenry was Secretary of War under Washington. Randolph acted as Attorney General for Washington and later as his Secretary of State. Rutledge, a distinguished jurist, was Chief Justice of the United States, Supreme Court. Oliver Ellsworth, absent when the Constitution was signed, was also later a Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. Blair, Patterson, and Wilson were later justices of the Supreme Court. Wilson had been on the Board of War and Ordnance in the Second Continental Congress. Benjamin Franklin, a philosopher and scientist, had been behind him years of most distinguished and successful diplomatic service. King was later a senator and thereafter minister to Great Britain. Charles Pinckney was minister to Spain. Dickinson founded Dickinson College, and Johnson was president of Columbia College. Gary was later vice president of the United States, and Ingersoll a candidate for the vice presidency. Gorham and Mifflin had been presidents of the Continental Congress. Clymer, Continental Treasurer. Robert Morris, Superintendent of Finance. Sherman, a member of the Board of War and Ordnance, all in the Continental Congress. We might add the other Morris, Gouverneur, and the other Pickering, Charles Coatley. There were many other distinguished men. They were distinguished before the time of the convention. They won great distinction after. They were all seasoned patriots of loftiest patriotism. They were not backwoodsmen from the far-off frontiers, not one of them. What a group of men of surpassing abilities, attainments, experience, and achievements. There has not been another such group of men in all the 170 years of our history. No group that even challenged the supremacy of this group. Gladstone said, "The American Constitution is the most wonderful work ever struck off at a given time by the brain and purpose of man." When God puts his hand to the plow, his furrow is deep and straight, clear to the end. God gave us the heritage. Ours is the duty to cherish and protect it. We have, as a people, a special relationship to these men and their work. In a revelation to Joseph at Kirtland, at the time of some of the darkest days in Missouri, December 16, 1833, where there seemed to be no protection for the saints from the civil authorities, the Lord spoke. He told the people to continue to importune for redress. According to the laws and constitution of the people, which I have suffered to be established and should be maintained for the rights and protection of all flesh, according to just and holy principles, that every man may act in doctrine and principle pertaining to futurity, according to the moral agency which I have given unto him, that every man may be accountable for his own sins in the day of judgment. Therefore, it is not right that any man should be in bondage one to another. And for this purpose have I established the constitution of this land by the hands of wise men whom I raised up unto this very purpose and redeemed the land by the shedding of blood. A little time before this, the Lord declared that the constitutional principle of freedom in maintaining rights and privilege belongs to all mankind and is justifiable before me, and that the people should renounce war and proclaim peace. When the Lord gave these approving revelations, the Constitution with its coterminous Bill of Rights was almost 50 years old. Two amendments only had been made. One concerned the federal judicial power, the other the election of president and vice president. Some 30 years later came the next two amendments, terminating slavery and guaranteeing citizenship and its protection, so meeting the principle declared by the Lord in 33 regarding bondage of men one to another. These framers of the Constitution were the men whom the Lord raised up unto this very purpose and redeemed the land by the shedding of blood, making it ready for the blessings. Proclaim for all. No more clearly does it appear to me that Moses was so trained in the royal Egyptian courts that he could lead ancient Israel out of bondage, or that Brother Brigham was so trained in directing the exodus of the saints from Missouri to Nauvoo that he could lead modern Israel from the mobbings and persecutions of the East to the freedom of the mountain fastnesses of the West. Neither one was more clearly trained for this work than these framers were trained for theirs. Rich in intellectual endowment and ripened in experience, they were equally as the others in God's hands. He guided them in their epoch-making deliberations in Independence Hall. The framers were deeply learned in the facts of history. They were learned in the forms and practices and systems of the governments of the world, past and present. They were, in matters political, equally at home in Rome, in Athens, in Paris, and in London. They had a long, varied, and intense experience in the work of governing their various colonies. They were among the leaders of a weak and powerful people that had successfully fought a revolution against one of the great powers of the earth. They were among them some of the ablest and most experienced and seasoned military leaders of the world. As to all matters under consideration by the Convention, the history of the world was combed for applicable experience and precedents. The whole training and experience of the colonies had been in the common law. They knew its functions of legislative, executive, and judicial arms of government. Time is not available now to consider in detail the work of the Convention, nor the Constitution that was framed. A very few principles only, and they among the basic ones, may be mentioned. First, the Constitution provided for three departments of government: the legislative, the executive, and the judicial. These departments are mutually independent, the one from the other. Each department was endowed with all the powers and authority that the people thought the Constitution conferred that upon that branch of government. No branch of the government might encroach upon the powers conferred upon another branch of government. In order to forestall foreseeable encroachments, the Convention provided in the Constitution itself for a very few invasions by one or the other into one or the other departments, to make sure that the one department should not absorb the functions of the other or encroach thereon, or give an overbalancing power that authority again with hand authority against the other. These have been termed checks and balances. A third principle that was inherent in all the provisions of the Constitution was that none of the departments could delegate its powers to the other. The courts of the country have from the first insisted upon the operation of this principle. An examination of the records of the Convention will show how anxiously earnest the framers were to set up these and other principles of free government. The convention seems to have experienced no really serious difficulty in setting up a judiciary department, nor in certain aspects the legislative department with the power, with its powers, until it came to those powers which deal with matters that in some governments had been regarded as belonging to the executive. You will recollect that practically all of these framers had suffered under George III and his minister, Lord North. So they abandoned the British model, for, as Rutledge said, the fixed genius of the people of America required a different form of government. It might be noted that Washington, as the Revolution closed, had definitively scotched at Newburgh the kingship idea. Of course, the framers did not know, no living mortal then knew, that centuries before a prophet of the Lord had declared as to America, "Behold, this is a choice land, and whatsoever nation shall possess it shall be free from bondage and from captivity and from all other nations under heaven, if they will but serve the God of the land, who is Jesus Christ, who hath been manifested by the things which we have written." Nor did the framers know, again no living mortal then knew, that centuries after this prophecy, but still centuries before the framers met, another prophet had declared, "And this land shall be a land of liberty unto the Gentiles, and there shall be no king shall rule over, rise up unto the Gentiles." The unhappy, short-lived experience of Dom Pedro's in Brazil and of Maximilian in Mexico seems the exception that proved the rule. The Spirit of the Lord was leading. In providing for the executive department, there was considerable discussion as to whether the executive department should be one person or several. Commenting upon a proposal for three, Randolph said their unity would be the fetus of monarchy. Who should choose, elect, or appoint? The terms were used almost interchangeably. The chief executive was exhaustively debated. So was the problem of the length of his term, from 1 year to Hamilton's during good behavior, including the question whether he should be ineligible for re-election and whether he should be subject to impeachment. But one of their most searching examinations related to the war powers of government, including the power to declare war. It became clear very early in the debates that as chief executive, the president should execute the laws passed by Congress. But he was also made commander-in-chief of the Army and Navy of the United States and the state militia when called into the service of the United States. The delegates were fearfully anxious over this function of government. There was one suggestion that the commander-in-chief should not be permitted to go into the field with his troops, so fearful were they of his power. But in whom should rest the so-called war powers? This was the urgent problem. It soon became clear that the convention was unalterably opposed to endowing the president with these war powers. It was conceded he should have the power to repel invasions, but not to commence war, which meant he could not declare war. Various other potential actions by the executive were explored. Future presidents of the republic were conceived as including men capable of doing the things that ambitious men in power had done over the ages. Men were still human, and the same urges and ambitions they had. The earnest effort was to make as nearly impossible as could be the malfeasances of the past by men in high executive office in the future, and seemingly, perhaps, beyond everything else, as a practical matter, to prevent the president from taking us into war of his own volition. The framers, therefore, provided that the war powers, including the declaration of war, should rest exclusively in the Congress, both by supreme express provisions and, as the record shows, by the conscious intent of the framers. The net result may be stated thus: as chief executive, the president was to enforce the laws passed by Congress, including those passed by Congress in the exercise of the war powers that were explicitly and exclusively possessed by Congress. The Commander-in-Chief of the Army and Navy of the United States and of the militia of the states when called into the actual service of the United States, he was to direct the military operations thereof in the field with the powers incident thereto. These principles should never be forgotten by any free, liberty-loving American, the kind of American the Constitution and the Bill of Rights make of us, and in which they were designed to protect us. Furthermore, under our form of government, we the people of the United States, as the preamble of the Constitution declares, form this government. We alone are sovereign. We are wholly free to exercise our sovereign will in the way we prescribe. The sovereignty is not personal, as under the civil law. The Constitution expressly provides the only way in which we may change our Constitution. We may well repeat again, we the people have all the powers we have not delegated away to our government, and the institutions of government have such powers, and those only, as we have given to them. The total residuum of powers, including all rights and liberties not given up by us to federal or state institutions, is still in us, to remain so till we constitutionally provide otherwise. Under the civil law that basically governs continental Europe, the people have only such rights as a personal sovereign or his equivalent bestows, the residuum remaining in him or them. Wherever and whenever powers are exercised by any person or branch of our government that are not granted by the Constitution, such powers are to that extent usurpations. Will not each of you ask yourself this question? What would probably have happened if Joseph Smith had been born and had attempted to carry on his work of the restoration of the gospel and the holy priesthood, if he had been born and had sought to go forward in any other country in the world? Must we go far to see why God set up this people and their government, the only government on the face of the earth, since the Master was here, that God has formally declared was set up at the hands of men whom he raised up for that very purpose, and the fundamental principles of which he has expressly approved? Having in mind what the Lord has said about the Constitution and its framers, that the Constitution should be established and should be maintained for the rights and protection of all flesh, that it was for the protection of the moral agency, free agency God gave us, that its principles of freedom in maintaining rights and privileges belongs to all mankind, all of which point to the destiny of the free government our Constitution provides, unless thrown away by the nations. Having in mind all this, with its implications, speaking for myself, I declare that the divine sanction thus repeatedly given by the Lord himself to the Constitution of the United States, as it came from the hands of the framers, with its coterminous bills of rights, makes of the principles of that document an integral part of my religious faith. It is a revelation from the Lord. My belief and reverence its God-inspired provisions. My faith, my knowledge, my testimony of the restored gospel, based on the divine principle of continuous revelation, compel me so to believe. Thus have the Lord approved of our political system, an approval, so far as I know, such as he has given to no other political system of any other people in the world since the time of Christ. The Constitution, as approved by the Lord, is still the same great vanguard of liberty and freedom in human government that it was the day it was written. No other human system of government, affording equal protection for human life, liberty and the pursuit of happiness, has yet been devised or vouchsafed to man. Its great principles are as applicable efficient and sufficient to bring today the greatest good to the greatest number as today as they were the day the Constitution was signed. Our Constitution and our government under it were designed by God as an instrumentality for righteousness through peace, not war. Speaking of the destiny that the Lord has offered to mankind in his declarations regarding the scope and efficacy of the Constitution and its principles, we may note that already the Lord has moved upon many nations of the earth so to go forward. The Latin American countries have followed our lead and adopted our constitutional form of government, adapted to their legal concepts, without compulsion or restraint from us. Likewise, the people of Canada in the British North America Act have embodied great principles that are basic to our Constitution. The people of Australia have likewise followed along our governmental footpath. In Canada and in Australia, the great constitutional doctrines of John Marshall and his associates are quoted in their courts and followed in their adjudications. I repeat, none of them has come because of force of arms. God's principles are taken by men because they are eternal and true and touch the divine spirit in men. This is the only true way the government that permanent world peace, the aspiration of men from the beginning, that has been devised. God never planted his spirit, his truth, in the hearts of men from the point of a bayonet. The framers had their dark days in their work. There were discouragements. There were hours of near hopelessness for some. Yet, as they were engaged in God's work and he was at the helm, we know it was as certain as the day dawned that Satan would be there also with his thwarting design. But I see in their diverse views, their different concepts, even the promotion of their different local interests, not the confusion which challenged Franklin, but a searching, almost meticulous study and examination of the fundamental principles involved and the final adoption of the wisest and best of it all. I see the winnowing of the wheat, the blowing away of the chaff. On one of these dark days, the venerable Franklin, ripened years and inexperience, arose and spoke to the convention. Said he, "The small progress we have made after 4 or 5 weeks, close attendance and continual reasonings with each other, our different sentiments, our almost every question covered of the last, producing as many eyes as nose, is, methinks, a melancholy proof of the imperfections of the human understanding. We indeed seem to feel our own want of political wisdom. In this situation of this assembly, how has it happened, sir, that we have not hitherto once thought of humbly appealing to the Father of Light to illuminate our understandings? In the beginning of the contest with Great Britain, when we were sensible of danger, we had daily prayer in this room for the divine protection. Our prayers, sir, were heard, and they were graciously answered. We have been answered, sir, in sacred writings, that except the Lord build the house, they labor in vain that build it. I firmly believe this, and I also believe that without his concurring aid, we shall succeed in this political building no better than the builders of Babel. And what is worse, mankind may hereafter, from this unfortunate instance, despair of establishing governments by human wisdom and leave it to chance, war, and conquest." So spoke Franklin. Out of more years, but of far, far less wisdom and experience, I echo Franklin's testimony that God governs in the affairs of men. And without his concurring aid, we shall build in vain, and our projects shall be confronted, confounded, and we ourselves shall become a reproach and byword down to future ages. I bear my testimony that without God's aid, we shall not preserve our political heritage, neither to our own blessing, nor to the blessing of our posterity, nor to the blessing of the downtrodden peoples of the world. In broad outline, the Lord has declared through our Constitution his form for human government. Our own prophets have decided, declared, in our day, that responsibility of the elders of Zion in the preservation of the Constitution. We cannot, guiltless, escape that responsibility. We cannot be laggards, nor can we be deserters. On the back of the chair in which Washington sat as president during the convention was carved a half-hidden sun, showing just above a range of hills. As the signing of the Constitution was about over, Franklin observed to some fellow delegates, "I have often and often, in the course of the session and the vicissitudes of my hopes and fears, as its issues looked at that sun behind the president, without being able to tell whether it was arising or setting. But now, at length, I have the happiness to know that it is arising and not a setting sun." Such was the prophecy that marked the closing of the greatest political convention of all time, for the Lord was there working out his purposes in a system he could endorse. God give us the power, each of us, to enshrine in our hearts the eternal truths of our Constitution, that come what may, we shall never desert these truths, but work always and unceasingly that, as Lincoln said, government of the people, by the people, and for the people shall not perish from the earth. Such is my prayer, and I ask it in the name of Jesus. Amen. Amen.